August 13th, 2018, and it's your episode 159 of At Percussion. I'm your host, Casey Cangelosi, and with me, as usual, are Laurel Black.
Hi.
And Megan Arnes.
Hello.
Megan, how was the New Hampshire Festival?
It was good. It was really fun. It's in the beautiful White Mountains, and so lots of hiking in addition to some good rep. Yeah, ran into our podcast friends, Bill Schultes and Matt Sherrick. So that was really cool. Yeah.
That is really good. Also joining us is Ben Charles, as usual. What's up, Ben?
Hey, everybody.
So you guys, our guest today is the new director of bands at Tarleton State University. There with Ben, taught public school at Arkansas for 4 years before beginning his career in higher education. He studied at Arkansas State University as well as the University of Missouri. And I guess that's, Megan, is that your University of Missouri?
I don't think it's my University of Missouri.
Oh, okay.
It is.
It is?
Yeah, Columbia, yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought it was UMKC.
Oh, no.
Wow, cool. Oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah, we'll just, maybe we should just sit here and talk about Columbia the whole hour. You want to do that?
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay. I'm into it. Well, and also the University of North Texas, he studied. So you guys, this is Dr. David Robinson. How's it going?
It's good. Thanks for having me, y'all.
Yeah, sure. Did you meet Ben in North Texas, or are you guys just meeting each other there at Tarleton?
Well, actually, you know, it's a funny story. The summer before I started at North Texas, so we're talking 2009, the Wind Symphony, and the Wind Symphony, there's a summer version of the Wind Symphony that does a conductor's workshop, and that year they were playing at the WASB conference in Cincinnati, World Association of Symphonic Bands and Ensembles. And so they did the 2 weeks of the conductor's workshop and did a short recording session, and then ended up going and playing at this conference the next week. And I was on my way in, so I decided to come in for the summer and just kind of see how things worked. And Ben was on his way out and playing in the group. I assume we met, but I don't really remember.
Yeah, we met a little bit.
Yeah, it's one of those. We did, and we were Facebook friends, but I kind of wanted those things. So
I wanted to ask David, actually, because part of the reason we're having him on is because he's our new band director here at Tarleton. Could you tell us a little bit about the process of getting, well, I guess maybe a little bit about finishing up your doctorate and then getting into your first job and moving on to a new job and the process of getting a college teaching job? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sort of the how to get from a doctoral program to a job sort of thing. Yeah, well, mine is first thing I should probably say is I'm one of the one of those folks that did not finish his doctorate on campus. So it took me actually 4 years to finish the paper after I left my residency in North Texas. For all of those out there, that is highly not recommended, trying to finish your doctorate while doing a full-time job. But I was lucky enough to find a full-time tenure-track job without my doctorate done, something that's getting extremely hard to do in higher ed. But I was able to do that and worked you know, made the decision like a lot of people do when you get one of those jobs is that's where your time goes. And I sort of worked on the paper in my spare time and finally got to the point where I realized that wasn't going to work. And it took about a month, the middle of the year, and I did my job during the day. And about 5 o'clock, I went home and had some dinner and then came back to the office and was there writing for about 8 hours and then went home and started the whole process over again. And that's kind of the only way that I figured out how to do it. But yeah, you know, finding college jobs is becoming harder. You know, it's, you know, in the percussion world, it's obviously, you know, for studio teachers, it's really hard because there's just a lot of really good people out there. But my process, I mean, just like a lot of other people was, send lots of, just apply for everything, you know, kind of see what sticks. But you know, the jobs that I got traction on were the ones that, that I had some sort of in on. Either there was a geographic in, or maybe there was something on my CV that sort of struck out, hey, that might be a good fit, or, somebody that I knew. And the ones that the job that I ended up having, that I ended up getting, was all three of those lined up. It was, I happened to know some people, and geographically it worked out, and I had the right kind of experiences.
Were you actually in school with any of our faculty?
I actually was not, no. And, you know, the thing, I don't know if I was going to give advice, I guess, since I'm talking to probably mostly percussionists out there, is even though I didn't, there are actually four members of the faculty here at Tarleton that I had met before I applied for this job. I didn't go to school with any of them, but I had known them in passing or know other people. And
to be clear, what we're talking about is these are people that went to UNT before.
North Texas, yeah. So the place where everybody is. So I had either met them or known them or worked with them in some capacity, and I guess I had fooled them enough that I was a good person and knew what I was talking about, that they decided to take a chance on me. But it's interesting, you know, because I've been on the other side of that equation too, and I've been on my previous job at McMurray University was on, chaired one committee and was on a second committee to hire a percussion professor. And I found that to be the same thing. The people that we ended up hiring were people we knew. So we, had some sort of connection, or in one case, the person that had applied had actually applied previously and we'd had a good experience. There were some sort of geographical things, you know. So I think, you know, I think who you know, I think is really important. And it's probably harder, you know, for you percussionists, because the people that are going to be on your committee, if you're graduating with a DMA in percussion performance, the people on that committee are not percussionists. You know, those mm-hmm. are going to be trumpet players and band directors. So I think it's really important. And, you know, going back to my experience in North Texas, I remember distinctly on that trip, I remember several people at sort of hang gatherings buying me drinks, and I was trying to figure out why is that the case, and it was those people that figured out that I possibly could be on a search committee someday and we're trying to, you know, play the game.
Wow, and,
yeah, I know. And even if you look at North Texas, you know, there's a lot of graduate students in North Texas, but there is sort of an inner sort of, I don't want to say clique, but a group of people that sort of know that they need to know people that don't play their instrument and are really good friends with lots of other people across instruments. So for those of you in the percussion world that are looking to apply for jobs, those are things I would think about.
To be clear, I did not buy David any drinks.
That is correct. You don't buy me a drink, by the way.
It's you would have to be so careful how you do that, right? I mean, can't like here you are telling us this experience, like you could tell these people were doing it for that reason. I mean, isn't it? It seems like a bad idea to me, you know? It's like, really? Do you think, should you kiss ass, though, you know?
No, I don't. It didn't come across as, I don't mean that in a very, you know, none of them said that out loud, but, yeah. You know, it's, you know, they kind of wanted to, you know, they wanted to know who I was, and they knew, you know, the program I was a part of, and I was interested in, because they, you know, the more people you know, I think the more options you have professionally. And that could be, you know, in a job situation, but also in a clinic situation or, you know, all sorts of different things. So I didn't mean to take the conversation there. That's not exactly what I meant.
Oh, cool.
Kind of goes a lot of what John Parks talked about, I think, with making connections. And it's not like this slimy, I don't think it's focused on networking, but yeah, like when you're in music, you're going to meet people that know people. And I think it's important to make a good impression on people just on a personal level, much less, you know, that I think that turns into a professional relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are, you know, lots of people out there that, you know, try to do that in a very, you know, a sort of overly selfish sort of way. And, you know, those,
you know the type.
And those, you know, those rub people the wrong way. So I think it's kind of how you do it. And
that's all I'm saying too. It's just
trying
like
to network instead of trying to, you know, be overt about it.
Yeah, I guess I've seen a lot of people doing it just blatantly, overtly, obviously, and you can, yeah, as far as giving folks advice, it's like, yeah, keep in mind that people can tell if you're trying that too hard, you know, and I really like that you mentioned that if you're looking for a job, percussionists are not going to be, you know, you're replacing a percussionist at a university, it's not going to be that person you're replacing on your search committee, and it's pretty it's quite reasonable to make a splash in the percussion world, but to have that splash like go further out is harder. Go beyond the instrument.
And you know, to take that a step further, you know, sort of the language of each of the different instruments, you know, speaking, you know, band wise, you know, the percussion world doesn't quite operate the same way as the trumpet world, doesn't operate like the flute world, you know. So, you know, knowledge of those, kind of how they operate, how they network, how they recruit, those sorts of things is important as well.
But we all know the percussion world's the best. So,
well, for today, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, percussion
awesome. For the next hour, yeah.
So I was going to change the topic for just a second because I have a question that's still kind of an intro question for David. And it seems like you got hired in sort of a monumental year for the bands with it being its 100th anniversary, right?
Yeah, 100th year, not 100th anniversary. So the 100th anniversary of the band program will be in 2019. So this is the 100th year, and then we'll do the anniversary the next year. So, it's a big opportunity. You know, it's and there are already some conversations underway about how to appropriately do that. There's no better time to come into a program than to a year that something like that is happening.
Yeah, do you have any exciting plans for that?
Our university also loves fanfare just for fanfare's sake. So any opportunity, you know, the 97th anniversary, they'll do something. Yeah.
Sure. Everyone does, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And we're in discussions to do some bigger things. I'm sure there will be a large, either alumni gathering or some concert sort of thing. We've even toyed the idea of we believe the first band concert that happened on our campus, which I think was also 1919, happened at a gazebo across campus. So we're tentatively thinking about recreating that concert in some way or acknowledging that somehow with the performance. So stay tuned.
Awesome. Very cool.
Well, I think while Laurel has a moment of calm at home, we should have her catch us up on what you have for us today.
So this is another installment of the book, The Anatomy of Drumming by John Lamb. Today I'm going to talk about a really complicated activity that we all do, and that is sitting. You never knew that sitting could be complicated, but it is.
I'm so bad at sitting.
Mm-hmm. So you might be sitting now, driving or eating, whatever you're doing. And of course, we do it behind drum kits or even behind timpani at times. But the truth is, there's a way to sit that is helpful, and then there are a myriad of ways to sit that are not. So Lamb writes that sitting at balance is critical to any kind of effective foot technique, because if our spine is off balance, then the legs will be used to keep us upright. So I often use the word alignment, and that's the first thing I'm going to talk about here. We're going to talk about forward to backward balance, side to side balance, and then get into things like how high you should sit off the ground, for example, to where you can really use your feet effectively. So yeah, Megan says, I'm not sitting right. I'm not either. Not right now. I'm a fine example of this. Quick run through of what needs to be aligned with your sitting in balance, and you'll feel it. There are four places: the AO joint, which is the one that's kind of between your ears, top of your neck, the shoulders, the weight-bearing part of your lumbar spine. So that's the curve of your back, and the lumbar vertebrae are really huge. And if you remember from last time, I said they're actually about halfway through your torso. So they're right in the middle instead of closer to your back body. The last thing that's going to be in that balanced line are your sit bones. There are two, one on the left and one on the right, but you'll be balanced equally between them, and your shoulders will be nice and stacked on top. So let's talk first about front to back balance. One of the easiest ways to deal with all this is to talk about what the bad sitting does. So John writes that slouching forward is really hard on foot technique because it brings your center of gravity over your legs instead of being back sitting on the sit bones, which is part of the pelvis, like this huge part of the skeleton. Push up to keep your torso from falling over. It's also possible, however, to slouch forward and kind of lean backwards at the same time, which does bring the center of gravity back over your sit bones. And unfortunately, a lot of drummers do this. So they slouch in the spine, and then to make sure they can move their legs, they kind of lean back a little bit so that they have more freedom at the ankle. And yeah, it takes pressure off your legs, so that's good, but it adds pressure to your back, and you're still going to end up hurt in the long run. So, you know, to find that front to back balance, just think about aligning shoulders and your hips and your sit bones. I feel like that's the key, and then deal with your head a little bit later. That's the Cliff Note version of how to do it. Now to side-to-side balance, so left to right. Again, it's something that can be really common in drummers, as we might try to take weight off the bass drum leg by shifting it to the left, because you're probably going to play bass drum more than you're going to mess with your hi-hat. And naturally, that's not necessary, because then you're shifting your balance, and so you're just creating another problem by solving the first one in the wrong way. He says another reason for side-to-side imbalance is a wallet or something else in your back pocket, which pushes that hip forward, and that messes up your side-to-side. So you'll feel like, you know, one half of your butt is more in contact with the chair than the other half, and that means there's a bit of imbalance.
I've heard of that a lot, you know, especially for usually men who are keeping the wallets in their pockets, and that can lead to like pretty severe back problems if you do that for too long.
Yes.
I just get a hole in my back pocket in every pair of pants I own. It's got to put a stop to it.
You do.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, it's because we make so much money.
That's right.
I have. Yeah.
Fat wallet.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say that, Megan, because the very next sentence is that, yeah, the wallet or whatever's in your pocket can cause further problems because it compresses blood vessels and pinches nerves.
That's too much to worry about.
Yeah, so there it is.
crazy.
Mo money, mo problem. All right.
Yeah, mo money, mo problems. Yeah, so in terms of, you know, how can I tell if I'm balanced left to right when sitting? I mean, I think the easiest thing you can do is just pick your arms up and wiggle back and forth and try to feel both of your sit bones. And they should both feel equally heavy, and that's it. And you should be able to move your arms equally easily and both of your legs equally easily, and that's it. The last quick bit is about how high should you sit off the ground? Like, where should your throne be? And ultimately, what you want to do is make sure that your hips are never below your knee, first of all, because that's just the opposite of how the body's designed to work. And if you're going to err one way or the other, it's better to err higher seat, because that keeps the connective tissue around your hip area looser. So the further your hips drop towards the floor, the tighter the connective tissue gets, because you're rotating within that socket just a little bit. And so it tightens because it's moving further from its natural place. So sitting higher is a little bit better. And why many back doctors, like if you see a chiropractor or something, they'll probably tell you you need to sit higher, because that's something that can help you be more aligned more easily. I know I said that was the last bit. That was a lie. This is actually the last bit. And it's about the relationship between your ankle and your knee. So with us particularly, you're playing the pedals. You do want your ankles in front of your knees, which I think it's hard to sit any other way, but in case you're out there learning, make sure that your ankles are in front of your knees when you sit down to play the pedals. Yeah, if you're at a 90-degree angle, it's gonna feel awkward and it's gonna feel difficult. So you want them a few inches in between. And I'll add to this that when it comes to the mechanism that bends the knee, I've said this on the podcast before, but just to reiterate, that's not at the front of the knee where the kneecap is, it's at the back.
Okay.
Yeah, so we tend to think like, oh, I bend my knees, and I still do it. I think about the front of my knee, and then it gets really tight up there, but we actually bend from the back of the leg, not the front. And so I think that's a good little tidbit. It's a cool book. I'm still going through it. And John Lamb goes on to recommend, you know, certain kinds of thrones, if you would like. He's a big fan of Rock and Sock, it seems.
Oh, yeah. Rock and Sock is so comfy.
Yeah.
Does he say anything about heel up or heel down?
Not yet. He probably gets into it.
Okay. I feel I'm very opinionated about that. I don't know, do you guys play heel up or heel down?
David?
Yeah, David. Do you conduct heel up or heel down?
Yeah.
It depends. I mean, for me, for if it's like a funk thing, I play heel up. If it's like jazz, I play heel down.
Right. So if you're playing heavy, you play heel up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see. Do you know what you do, Megan? Or is it the same kind of, you do both?
Yeah, it depends. And it also sometimes depends. I mean, like, I'm not a great drum set player. So sometimes for me, it's like if I'm playing faster, I feel more comfortable with heel up.
Yeah.
And like hi-hat is usually, you know, a combination of the two.
I feel like I almost always play heel up. Even like sitting right here now, I put my heels up and all my weight goes into my butt. But as soon as I put my heels on the floor, I feel all this, like, I feel like instant action in my legs that doesn't.
Interesting.
Yeah.
My drum set teacher at Eastman, Rich Thompson, would always describe it like, stress the importance of making sure that you feel like a tripod, like with your butt too, you know, so that you're seated in a way where your weight is balanced between your two feet and your core. Yeah. And that was really helpful to me because, you know, if you're adjusted one way, you're using too much muscle to balance yourself. Right. You can't be free to do what it needs to do.
Yeah. Some of that, Casey, might be sitting. Like if you're sitting towards the front or the middle or the back of the throne, because it would be best to sit towards the front so yeah. that the throne's not in the way of what your legs need to do.
Part of your leg, yeah. And that helps with the balance too. I mean, like playing timpani, I think that's, I always explain that in a simple way. You know, when students are sitting really far back, it doesn't really make sense.
Right.
Yeah. And I think when we, whether timpani or drum set, we tend to sit with our pelvis kind of rolled forward a little bit, which makes our back a C, you know, your head top of the C. And it makes it curve like that. And I just know from my personal experience, when I really try to pay attention to how I sit, I always kind of feel like my butt is a little more tilted backwards than I would expect.
Right.
Or, yeah, right. My pelvis is tilted forward, so it feels like your butt is farther back.
but
that's what it takes. And so it might be a totally different sensation if anybody's going to go out and kind of mess with us for the first time in a really observant way. It might really feel different, but it probably feels different in a good way.
Real quick, Laura, what was the name of the book again?
Anatomy of Drumming.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Yeah, it makes me think of being at UNT and getting to see all of Ed Soph's students, and Ed Soph probably has, or he's retired at this point, but probably had the best drum set studio in the United States, or at least one of the top three. And I remember my friend Michael D'Angelo, who we had on the podcast quite a while back, who is one of Ed's students, talked about Mike started playing drums really young, like 5 years old or something like that. And he said that he had always played heeled up, and he played heel up so much that he just, like, he trained everything. Like, he walked, like, on the balls of his feet just out of habit of how he played drums, yeah.
Right.
And I do know that most shoes that we wear, shoes have, like, a relatively thick sole at the back. Like, if you think about what running shoes look like. And I know that our, like, Achilles tendons actually shorten from that. So, like, I know, like, people that go to, like, if you go to the gym on leg day, people will actually wear flat shoes so they can, like, extend their heels fully or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's the whole, like, minimal drop, zero drop shoe craze.
I just got back from a little tour. I know you guys know this, but our listeners probably don't. I started in Chicago at Northwestern University and taught and performed it there, Chi Wu's percussion seminar, and then I went to University of Oregon and did Pius Chang and Eriko's Beta percussion seminar, and then I went to Greece, so flew from San Francisco to Copenhagen, which was a really long flight across the United States, then over the ocean, And then, of course, I did Theodore Milkov's thing there in Greece. And you guys, that's so much time on a plane. And, and you know, everything we've talked about on the show, especially with this book, Laurel's mentioned a few times now, but even talking with Josh Jones of Feldenkrais Technique, and it's all just about, you know, the thing that keeps coming up is just awareness and body awareness. And you, and I really kept that in mind, because usually the plane rides just wreck me. Like, they, I really sit bad and I can never be comfortable. And you're not even doing anything. You're just sitting there. But this trip went so much better. I made such a conscious effort to try to just sit comfortably. And it really worked. I can't even tell you specifically what I did other than just be aware of it. So it was, it was really good thing to learn. Megan,
I was just going to say, Casey, your adventures looked awesome, but there was one picture you posted that looked like you were like in wine country or something out in the farm. Where was that?
Yeah. So that's where Theodore Milkov hosts his marimba festival.
It looked beautiful.
It was really, really pretty. Yeah. He puts everyone in little cabins, and it's a farm in Greece. And I tried to ask him, like, where is this exactly? And the village does have a little name, but it wasn't even, he just said it's in the Parnassus Mountains outside of Delphi. Like, that's where it is.
Okay.
So, yeah, even just pinpointing exactly where it was is kind of not that easy. But I got a photo of the name of the farm and everything. So it's up there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, thanks. It was really, really beautiful. And it was great to do this little tour, because the three percussion seminars were really different and really good. And,
cool.
And I would recommend them to anybody. I can't even tell you which one to do over the other. But, of course, the Northwestern Seminar, Shi Yi Wu, just had an amazing roster of guests. And then Pius Chang and Erico ran their thing, which was all about performance and composition. And then Theo's just sort of felt like a retreat. You know, the students were practicing all day, and there were lessons during the day. And then there was always a concert at night. So it was really, laid back.
Casey, I have a question about Pius's thing in particular.
Sure.
One performer that I know is just an icon that I'm like ashamed to admit I don't know a whole lot about, other than he taught at Michigan and worked with Keiko Abe, is Michael Udow.
I didn't know much about him either. He's such a sweet guy. He's like the happiest person I've ever met.
I think Pius posted he was returning from a 6-year hiatus in performing or something like that.
Yeah, that's what I learned also. And we played together his piece Coyote Dreams, which is sort of like a marimba spiritual that I guess Erico has played before. And man, yeah, lots I can say about that, because I posted this little video where I would keep a hi-hat quarter note against all these mixed meters, which was really challenging and a really good way to keep me excited about practicing. And I got some of these sit questions that came up because my foot would get exhausted practicing for this. But Mike Udow, well, what can I say? I mean, he's just such a wonderful dude. He's just like the sweetest person ever. He's super, super happy. And he performed wonderfully after 6 years and gave a fantastic clinic. And yeah, I couldn't say enough good stuff about him and it.
Very cool.
Yeah. Sorry, one more thing about feet and pedals. Our friend from the podcast, Jade Hales, who you guys know, he's submitted several questions. He played anvil chorus for me at the Beta Percussion Seminar, and I had spent way too much time on the two people before. I had a 2-hour masterclass. I spent way too much time the performers before him, so I had to kind of stick to one thing on anvil chorus, but I decided to tackle the pedals and the like standing positions. When you guys play multi, do you like to do one pedal forward, one pedal back, or have you ever had to tackle that? I hate having a pedal behind me, but it would be so advantageous, because when they're both in front of you and you have to play both and you're standing, there's no good place to put your weight.
Yeah. Real quick, I just wanted to mention for the uninitiated, the anvil course has what, like 4 foot pedals or something like that, or at least I've seen it done that way. I mean, it's like, it's a lot of foot choreography.
Yeah. It occurs to me, if I would ever do it, I would sit down.
Yeah.
Does anyone do that?
I had a student who was sitting down, and she kept going back and forth and ultimately ended up standing.
Yeah.
just to have the mobility to get around.
I like standing so much, and it takes a lot for me to have to sit. But I look at that one, and I think, oh, maybe I would sit for that one. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's...
For what it's worth, I think Steve Schick stands.
That's the right way to do it, then.
Yeah.
Yeah, hey, how about a Facebook question for David? Enough of this foot pedal stuff. By the way, thanks, Laurel. That was fantastic.
Yeah, cool.
So we had a Facebook question from our friend Kai Stinsgaard, who appeared on the podcast a while back, and he said, what is the best way for a composer to get his work for wind ensemble performed, or where do the orchestras find new works?
Oh, that's a good one. Well, the good news, you know, for any composers that might be out there listening, the good news is, you know, I studied with Eugene Corporon at North Texas, not to name drop, but he had saying that I thought was really, really apropos to this. He said that the wind ensemble, wind symphony, or whatever we call ourselves now, is the new music ensemble. It really is the new music ensemble of the 21st century, and not to diminish other ensembles that are of that also do new music, but you know, new music is really hip with concert bands now, especially the college scene. You know, there are hundreds of college band directors in the country, and the focus on new works is pretty intense. Everybody's trying to find that one, you know, trying to find that one composer, the next big composer, or in a lot of cases trying to find or get that really, really hot orchestral composer to compose for bands. So the appetite is definitely there. So it's a matter of where do you go? My suggestion to a composer would be to try to find someone that you maybe you have an in with, or maybe it's close to you. Maybe the university is closest to you, or maybe you have a mutual acquaintance of. And I would email or call that person, and I would say, I've written a couple works for band. Can I get your thoughts on these? And get that person, you know, talking about what they like about that piece and what they don't, and have a little skin in the game. And a lot of times those conductors are going to program your works, or at least are going to find a performance for your work. And if you can get, and you know, the trick is to get a good, if you get a good piece as a composer and you get a conductor or two that have played it and really dig it, it's going to show up on some divisional CBDNA program or something, and then everyone's going to be playing it. So it's really not that hard. If you can just get a college band director or a well-connected high school director to play, give you some comments, and then you can get a name for yourself pretty quickly.
Well, I was just going to say, I know this is something that John Mackey and Steve Bryant have both talked about with their works, and John Mackey talks about being so excited to compose for band because he gets so many performances and two orchestra performances at best a year or something like that. And I know Steve Bryant has expressed the same. And I was wondering, I don't know if you would know this or not, being a wind ensemble conductor, but for example, I know Steve Bryant made a version of Ecstatic Waters for orchestra, mm-hmm. and I don't think it was a direct transcription. I think mm-hmm. he moved some stuff around. But do you know, do composers charge more for orchestra works because they don't get performed as much or anything like that?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it probably depends on who you talk to. But there are now, you know, mentioning the orchestra to band deal, there are a number of works out there that have started in the wind world and gone to the orchestra world. I mean, go back to English Folk Song Suite. Actually, there's an orchestral version that Gordon Jacob did of that. And doesn't get really played that much anymore, but there's a orchestra version that Karel Husted did of Music for Prague. And even like Frank Kelly, I just heard Abilene Christian do the Intercollegiate Orchestra do, there's now an Angels in the Architecture version for orchestra, which I like the band version better because I'm a band guy, but that is a thing out there.
Hmm. Well, as a nice little segue into a new topic here, I wanted to talk about a composer and one of his famous works, but there's a quote from this composer, I believe from the 1950s, and he said, band music is virtually the only kind of music in America today which can be introduced, accepted, put to immediate and wide use, and become a staple of the literature in a short time. And this composer, apparently at the time, the word band was kind of gross word, and serious composers didn't want to write for band because it had a connotation of sort of sloppy performances and community bands and not very high level playing. And I find it interesting that this composer took a very significant interest in writing for band. And this composer, for the uninitiated, is Vincent Persichetti. And in particular today, I wanted to get into talking about his first symphony. His sixth symphony, his symphony for band. And it's funny because Vincent Persichetti is, I think you would agree, like one of the standard, most significant band composers of all time. And everyone that's ever played in a band knows Granger, Lincolnshire Posey, Holst's First Suite, the Hindemith Symphony, but I feel like so many people aren't familiar with these works of Vincent Persichetti. I did my research mostly from a master's paper from the University of Illinois. If you're interested in more, it's about this symphony, and it's by Michael Wayne Chester. It's called A Conductor's Analytical Study of Vincent Persichetti's Symphony for Band, Symphony No. 6, Opus 69. And then the legendary Eastman Wind Ensemble conductor, Frederick Bunnell, has a book called A Conductor's Interpretive Analysis of Masterworks for Band, which I'm assuming you probably own.
It's probably over there.
Yeah.
Either that or it's in one of the boxes that I haven't unpacked yet.
And there's a chapter on Persichetti in there. And I, to be clear, I didn't read that book, but this master's paper referenced it quite a bit. Just to start, a little bit of background about Vincent Persichetti. Vincent Persichetti was born June 6, 1915 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He enrolled in the Combs College of Music. It sounds like it was sort of a pre-college program, but he started at the age of five, studying piano, and he soon followed with studies in harmony, counterpoint, tuba, double bass, and organ. He began to audit college-level music theory classes taught by Russell King Miller at the age of nine, and he considered Miller his most influential teacher. He had his first original works performed publicly at the age of 14, and he graduated from Combs Conservatory in 1936. And upon his graduation, he actually joined the faculty as the conductor of the orchestra. Later, he studied on scholarship with Fritz Reiner at Curtis, and he earned an artist diploma from Curtis in 1938, and he also studied piano at the Philadelphia Conservatory. Later, he began teaching at Juilliard, and his works were performed by, or sorry, he had works premiered by significant performers, including Ormandy and the Philadelphia Orchestra. He has over 175 works in various genres, including opera, orchestral works, and 13 works for wind band. He earned three Guggenheim Fellowships, a Medal of Honor from the Italian government, citations from the American Bandmasters Association, and more awards. His former students included some very familiar names, Philip Glass, Steve Reich, and P.D.Q. Bach, who's the famous musical parodist, if you're familiar with him. So a little bit about his symphony for band. He received a commission after the completion of his fifth symphony, which was for strings, from the band program at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. The director of bands, whose name was Clark Mitzi, requested an eight-minute work for an instrumental ensemble primarily composed of winds, but not necessarily for band. And he left the final instrumentation up to Persichetti. After creating some of his sketches for the symphony, Persichetti came back and said that he wanted to write a 15-minute symphony and four movements, and so that was agreed upon. The commission fee was actually doubled from $500 to $1,000, and the work was premiered on April 16, 1956, in St. Louis, Missouri, by the Washington University Band under Clark Mitzi. It was at an MENC conference, I think. The symphony is in four movements. The movements are fast, slow, medium, and fast. And I find it interesting, Persichetti apparently took quite a bit of pride in his Italian heritage. And if you look at the score, it's just littered all over with Italian terms, some which are familiar musical terms like conforza, piano, accelerando, and so on. And then some are not so commonly, if ever, used in music outside of Persichetti, including the two that I see a lot are chiaro, which means clearly, and ruvido, which means rough. And ruvido comes up a lot, especially in the last movement.
And spaghetti.
And spaghetti is also, yeah, the noodles are in there, yeah. Persichetti used a technique in many of his works, especially the symphony, where he sort of created choirs and smaller instrumental ensembles within those choirs. And the thing that I find so notable about this symphony for band is that the percussion choir is treated with equal significance to the woodwind and brass players. And there are only three percussionists, which we'll get to their instrumentation later, but there are only three percussionists, so they're quite busy keeping up with all of the wind and brass players. To my ear, this is just my opinion, the percussion writing sort of reminds me of Stravinsky's Histoire du Soldat. It has sort of multi-drum setups, that sort of very early multi-percussion style with snare drums and tom-toms and bass drums. And then also the xylophone writing reminds me of the Bartok Sonata with sort of quirky little single-line melodies in the sort of upper register of the xylophone being played. He clearly had specific colors in mind when he was writing for the percussionists, and much like in the Bartok Sonata, he goes to great detail to indicate with a soft mallet or with a stick or anything like that. And one example that Bartok and Persichetti both use is that they play triangle with wooden sticks, which creates this new instrument sort of clacky sound. The three percussion instrumentations are: player one has three timpani and a suspended cymbal. Player two has three snare drums, soprano, alto, and tenor, suspended cymbal, tambourine, tom-tom, and triangle. And player three has bass drum, tenor drum, sizzle cymbal, and xylophone. And if you listen to the first 20 bars of the first movement, which is an adagio, it's interesting. There's this lyrical horn solo going on, and underneath the percussionists play, I don't know how much, but a very large portion of the thematic material used throughout the piece. And if you want a really clear example, if you count in the sixth bar, which is approximately 30 seconds in on a recording, you hear the timpani play this dum digga dum digga 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 dum motif, and then that returns in the fourth movement as this bugle call. You hear bum da da dum ba da 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 dum, something like that. So yeah, there's so much attention and prevalence and importance placed on the percussionists in this work. And I think it's safe to say that, you know, the early band works like the Holes First Suite were really what solidified the instrument or the percussionist in, or sorry, the band wind ensemble genre as a valid instrumental genre. And I think Persichetti is the, to my mind anyway, the first percussion composer, the first composer to really utilize percussion in a sort of modern sense with equal importance to the winds, and really, really put important material in the percussion, not use them as sort of a battery component like Holst does in that first suite. So David, I warned David I was going to do this. I wanted to ask, to me, it's interesting that Persichetti has this very interesting, very busy writing style, but then I can't really find anything directly after, and obviously percussionists and wind ensemble are very busy today, but it's a different sort of busy. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us historically sort of what followed Persichetti in your opinion? And maybe you could even take that into where you see percussion going in the future.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a good segue. Yeah. I think, you know, just kind of back up. Well, first of all, I do want to mention that I don't know if Ben has mentioned this on your podcast. Ben, I'm a little jealous. Ben actually studied conducting with Gary Green at Miami while he was there doing his doctorate. So so Ben has some credibility on this. And we kind of nerded out last night over dinner talking about band works. But no, I think you hit the head right on the nail right on the head with the discussion about how important this piece is to percussionists. For me, this is a top 10 work. I mean, this is up there with Posey and the Hindemith Symphony and so on. But yeah, I think, you know, up until this point, in the 50s were a big point for the concert band, one ensemble, whatever you want to call it. Because up to that point, you know, the percussion group was completely subservient to woodwinds and brass. I mean, that's just no other way to say it. I think maybe the exception of that might be Granger, because we kind of forget that Granger is a little bit out in front with a lot of stuff. And I think some of his writing was pretty avant-garde for the time. But also Granger was considered avant-garde, you know, the first person, but Persichetti, because of his credentials as a composer, because of his professorship, you know, when Persichetti did it, that lent some credibility to what was going on. And, you know, this piece, you know, Persichetti, this is the, you know, sixth symphony for band. This was right after Fifth Symphony for Strings. It's just he just approached the writing of this as another symphony and just wrote it. The percussion is just another section. And I think that's probably the thing that makes this the most important, is that he didn't feel like he had to start with the winds and then go to the percussion. You can tell that there are several points in the symphony that he started with percussion sounds and then went from there. You know, Ben talked about the motivic grabbing of the things in the first 20 bars, those diggity-dum sort of things that come back. So there's that. And then there's also his use of color. You know, there are several different sounds in that symphony. Because he really didn't use that many instruments. He used only three players, but not that many instruments. There's lots of other things that he could have wrote for, but he chose to get a lot of different sounds out of few instruments, which I think is a good lesson for composers these days. But as far as where we go, you know, I think we've started this. I would say, you know, since this point, I think we've had a pretty successful I don't know if this is the right term to use, but sort of equal rights movement of percussion in wind groups, which I think was long overdue. You can see there are some things that I'll just pick off a few pieces that have happened after that I think are very important. Two right offhand right in the 60s that follow this Persicetti was written in the 50s, but two pieces that come to mind are variations on a folk song. I think doesn't get historical, you know, context. Two really important things about that piece. One is the whole woodblock thing. You know, using the woodblock as a melodic instrument. It really, to my mind, you know, John Barnes Chance was using that as a woodwind instrument. You know, it's just, you know, the middle section, diggity-dum, diggity-dum, diggity-dum. So that's just, he used it as another instrument to sort of fill in, played with the woodwinds and play without the woodwinds. And then I think an even bigger thing about that, later on in that same variation, it gets to the sort of the third phrase of that theme, dum, 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 dum. And it's actually stated by the vibraphone. And the woodwinds, and I think horn is in there as well, actually mimic and color the vibraphone. So he actually started with the vibraphone and then used the woodwind instruments to provide extra color to sort of the bleed of the vibraphone. And you can kind of see that's sort of you can see Persicetti sort of following from that. So you see things like that. I think, you know, Rocky Point Holiday, I think it's a big piece. You know, we forget that that's a 60s work as well, as far as using lots of different instruments.
Maybe the coolest marimba part in the band.
The marimba, yeah, because you listen to that piece. You know, I just did that piece last year, and the percussion professor, Johnny Mendoza, hi, if you're watching, Johnny, we were talking about this piece and how important it was, and then we said, you know, I didn't realize that was 1966. You know, that was not something that was done to have a real legitimate marimba part in 1966. But then you get going on, like in the 70s and 80s, you know, Schwantner, I think the, you know, sort of the industrial sounds of, you know, Dark Millennium and Mountains Rising, I think are really important. To where, you know, I think we've gotten to today. And I think this is something that I think conductors really need some help from the percussion world is that there are just so many things going on back there. You know, about every fifth score that I open, there's a percussion instrument that I, or some technique or some percussion instrument that I've got to go ask, what is that?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
which is kind of pain because we have to go buy that stuff. But it's, you know, the percussion world is expanding so rapidly. You know, I was thinking sort of and trying to get my head wrapped around for this interview, how, you know, my percussion techniques class that I took almost 20 years ago, how almost inadequate that is now. It wasn't, had nothing to do with the guy that I took it from. It's just that so much has developed technique-wise and instrument-wise that for us, as we get older, we're having to do, you know, continuing ed to sort of keep up with the percussion world, which is a great thing that percussion continues to evolve. But I think as far as where we're going, I think that's one of the biggest challenges. And then I think, you know, to me, I think, you know, talking about an equal rights movement of the percussion world, I think we still haven't quite gotten, and I think maybe there's a couple of composers that have gotten there, to treat every percussion instrument as an equal among all equals. Because I think we see the percussion as section as part of an equal part of the wind band, but I'm not sure that we continually see every instrument as its own thing. There are still certain instruments that are subservient. you know, suspended cymbal. Just the use of that instrument is so cliche. We've got to get past that in wind writing. Bass drum and snare drum, kind of the same thing. We've got to get that we have all of those instruments and we know how to use them. And I think that's part of that is just, I think a lot of composers out there aren't really comfortable writing for percussion, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. They kind of, you know, many of them, I don't think, aren't really willing to do, you know, there's stories about Karel Husa, I think while he was at Cornell, you know, he didn't really know a lot about percussion, but I think the drill was that he would, on Friday afternoon, he'd go by the percussion professor, hey, can I borrow the key to the studio this weekend? He would just sit in there and just play different instruments all weekend and then bring the key back on Monday. Thanks, I got it. And
that's cool.
Yeah, so I had just two other composers that I wanted to mention in the sort of evolution of percussion and band. One, we would be completely off mark if we didn't mention David Mislanka and his use. and that's someone that you talk about. Some people are almost afraid to write for percussion. David Mislanka, I think, was almost too fearless. Things that were just borderline unplayable.
Yeah.
And then one other new, very sort of hip composer. Are you guys familiar with the composer Paul Dooley?
I know the name.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Born 1983, and he has a piece, and I'm blanking on the name now. I played it when I was at Miami. I wish I could remember it. I'll find it in a minute. But it uses drum set and like sort of like techno drum beats within wind ensemble, and I think he has a very sort of hip, fearless take on how to use percussion in the wind ensemble. And that piece, which I'll find the name of in a minute, was actually an orchestra transcription, transcribed for band. And he used percussion actually to take over a lot of the string effects, because if you think about it, strings can start extremely soft, as can percussion instruments. Winds sort of need a certain minimum volume in order to respond. So a lot of sort of swells and things come from the percussion instrument in that piece. But I didn't know if you'd ever done any Paul Dooley or
I haven't done any Paul Dooley. No, he's on my to-do list, but I so not as familiar with Paul. We couldn't have this discussion without talking about David Mislanka. And if someone could tell me how to play the second bar of Travel, that I've heard people do it, but that's kind of crazy. We've been blessed, you know, not to change the subject, but we've been blessed in the wind band world of
sorry to interrupt.
You found it.
No, I didn't, but I found a quote from some composer named Steve Reich said about Paul Dooley that his music is impressive and beautiful, which is Steve Reich says that. That's a sort of a big deal. And that wind ensemble work is, I'm on his list, Point Blank. That was it.
Okay.
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
We did a piece of his, of Paul Dooley's, called Coast of Dreams last year here at GMU.
Yeah. Cool.
They had a big.
Well, so if Paul gets word of this, Paul, I'm coming for you. So, you're stuff's on my list. So, not to change the subject, but we've been blessed in the wind band world that we've had a good number of young, sort of hip composers that are writing. You know, Paul's only one. You know, I think Michael Malkowski, I'm going to do a piece of his on our first concert. David Biedenbender, is several other guys. And, you know, going back to the conversation about composers, you know, all of those people have somebody that have put them out there. Those folks don't, the good thing about those folks is a lot of, we're starting to get folks that have, with the exception of John Mackey, because John doesn't play an instrument, that grew up in the band world and don't have the prejudices of the 50s in their head. And those folks tend to be a little bit freer and have no fear about writing things. They have no fear about challenging percussionists, which has been an issue in wind band writing. But also have really fresh sounds. It's a point of excitement for me. So I'm glad Ben brought that up.
We have one of those composers coming up next week, Adam Silverman. He's written a lot of great stuff for wind band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think you're absolutely right, David. I know that whenever I swing by our band director up here, Steve Bolstead, whenever I swing by his office, he's listening to something, and it's something awesome. And I said, what the heck is that? And he says, oh, it's this new piece for, it's like, yeah, like there's one of those new guys who's writing something, new guys or girls who's writing something really hip for a band that we haven't discovered yet. Yeah. Ben, I was going to say there's a cool dissertation called The Examination of Innovative Percussion Writing in the Band Music of Four Composers, Persichetti, Husa, Schwantner, and Kohlgrass. And it does seem to follow a lineage of progress. And the first one that Craig T. Perry puts on there is the Persichetti, and it does talk a whole lot about the theme usage and the writing and the cohesiveness, and even says that it looks likely that Persichetti was reading or has read an article by Frederick Fennell in Percussive Notes to get some of this cool information.
And then, I mean, we could talk for an hour about Michael Kohlgrass. We'll refrain from going that long, but yeah, Michael Kohlgrass is another one. That Michael Kohlgrass was a percussionist that ended up, you know, becoming a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer and all of this. And so his percussion writing very much pushed the envelope. And pieces like "Winsome Nagual" and "Urban Requiem" are both just, I think, just, you know, monuments in the wind band repertoire. And "Winsome Nagual," there was a group at CBDNA, I think it was Texas Tech University, played that in Houston this past year. I saw that performance. It's a saxophone quartet concerto and tons and tons of percussion, and that was an outstanding performance. But yeah, that piece, just, it's like 30 minutes long, and I could just listen to it straight through at any moment in time. It's so good.
Yeah, sure.
Also has a drum set in it.
And yeah, and as far as percussionist writing for band, you know, I think it's also been a little bit of a move toward some people that really are not really composers, but kind of percussion guys. I mean, the name that comes to mind, Nathan Daughtry, who has, you know, started to sort of dabble in, you know, move some percussion ensemble, rescore some things for wind band. I think that's really helpful. Nathan's done some really good stuff. And it's also helped with, you know, another thing that composers have had some trouble with, is trying to make percussion parts work. We still have some work as far as, you know, a lot of composers want to, you know, have a good idea of what percussion instruments they want, but getting it on paper and then getting it to make it work where, you know, Persichetti, you know, going back to Persichetti Symphony, he wrote a lot of percussion stuff, but he took the time to make sure that it was playable by those three parts. And that's something we in the wind band world need to work at, because sometimes there will be, you look at the bottom of the score and there's five or six parts, but really you need about seven or eight players just because the thinking of that wasn't really done very well. And I think people like Nathan are helping us sort of figure out how to get past some of those issues.
Yeah, Nathan's great. We've had Nathan on the show, and yeah, we talk about Nathan. Yeah, definitely comes up now and again on the show for sure. I was going to ask David, what are some of those things that you think work really well? Like what type of percussion do you like to see? What are things that you don't like to see that maybe don't work? I know for me, it's often, I feel like composers hear marimba solo playing, or they hear marimba chamber playing, and they think, wow, the marimba is huge. And dude, you never hear it. And then they're like, louder, more marimba, more marimba. It's like, dude, I'm sorry. I'm not going to tell the student to break the marimba. It's badly scored.
Right.
This is flat out poor orchestration. And the marimba doesn't compete against a full band. It just doesn't, you know?
Yeah, well, I think there's two different issues there. I think there's one, there's the orchestrational issue of making sure that percussion is written correctly. And then two, which is a different issue, is, you know, where the piece, you know, the piece gets on the piece of paper and then it lands on my desk, of how to make the composer's intent work. So I think on the first point of those, you know, orchestrationally, I think it's pieces that are good, that have good percussion writing, there's been a lot of thought into the timbral, and I'm going to steal a Eugene Corporon word again, timbral qualifier. You know, how strong is that sound? What's the articulation? How much articulation do you want out of that sound? And then is it by itself? Is it paired with an instrument? How much of that instrument do you want to hear relative to the wind instrument? You know, there is... And the good ones for me are the ones that have, you know, innovative doublings or pairings. You know, there's some that are very, you know, very cliche, you know, bells and piccolo, those work very well, tuba and bass drum, tuba and timpani, those sorts of things. But, you know, when you see, you know, different sorts of, you know, going back to the vibraphone thing with the variations on a Korean folk song, I mean, that to me is super cool that, you know, that he took the time to, you know, figure out the vibraphone and what the vibraphone sounds like. And then I'm going to put all of these specific sounds, you know, thought about where all those instruments are. And you know, those kind of make the second part, when a composer does that, it makes the second part kind of easy. But it's actually, as a conductor, I find it fun when that actually isn't really thought very well. I'll go back to doing Rocky Point Holiday last year. I was talking to Lester McMurray, Johnny Mendoza, the percussion professor, and we were talking about, you know, the as far as things getting covered up, that marimba part in Rocky Point, you know, and we were talking about, now if this gets worked up, you know, what's the purpose of working this up if no one's going to hear it? And my answer to him was, well, that's my job to make sure that that gets heard. So for me, that's the fun part of trying to figure out, you know, how do I spin this? How much do I ask of the percussionist? How much sound can I get away with without distorting the resonance of the sound? Those sorts of things. Those are the fun decisions for me. So when it doesn't work out, I don't actually see that as a bad thing.
I was just going to say very quickly, Casey actually mentioned this article earlier. There's an article called A Modern Use of Percussion by Frederick Fennell. And I mean, it kind of, I think, sums up a lot of the discussion that we're having. But this is, I guess, what, 1950s that you wrote that article, give or take?
I think so, yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it, like all this sort of stuff we're talking about, Fred Fennell had a very acute idea of way back then. For example, he says, complex rhythms, when played with wooden sticks on notes at the lower extremes of the large drum, meaning timpani, are difficult to make sound with clarity. And I mean, that's just one sentence from this whole article that's basically just talking about exactly what we're talking about. And I think it could maybe be updated to include marimba and some of the more modern usages of instruments. But yeah, I think that's one of the biggest issues, is getting things to speak clearly underneath these, you know, muddy textures of brass.
Yeah, and I'm glad that Ben brought up Fred Fennell. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence. You know, Fred Fennell, obviously the founding conductor of the Eastman Wind Ensemble, is a percussionist, and I don't think that's a coincidence. I think there was some logic behind that.
Also brilliant.
Also brilliant. And you know, as far as the development of the percussion sound in the wind band, you've got to mention Frederick Fennell. I mean, how many band directors have listened to his Mercury recordings of Hall's First Suite, and you know, a good 50 works that went a long time that was the only recording that was out there, and those recordings were done with a percussionist on the podium. So I think, to be honest, I think some of those sounds are a little overdone today, but I think that's mostly because of the recording equipment back then. So,
gotcha. Yeah, good point. Every time I walk into this is just about band music is really fun for percussionists. Every time I walk into our rehearsals with Dr. Bolstad, our band director, and I'm, you know, just looking over everyone's shoulders and seeing if there's any way I can be useful. I mean, I just want to play. Just like, oh man, can I just play?
Same.
I don't feel like it's, and I mean, it would be great, you know, if we just had a little more time, can I just rotate myself into this next concert cycle? You know, it's like always fun, but we could probably talk a lot more about this, but I think it's time. Are you guys ready for your quiz?
Oh, geez.
Let's okay. Do it.
Okay, so Megan and Laurel are tied, and Ben is down by 2 is the current situation.
Which I still think is because I had a slow connection last time. Go on.
I think that's fair to say. And if this all gets a little more competitive and a little more personal and a little more contentious, that's okay. You know,
who's buying dinner at Pasek sort of thing, yeah.
Okay, let me pull up my little quiz here. So here we go. So the year 2015 saw the 20-year anniversary of what historic marimba competition?
The Lee Howard Stevens competition.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah, that's right. The Lee Howard Stevens International Marimba Competition and Festival in 1995. So Ben reported on this festival way back on episode 6, which is almost three years ago.
Wow.
This came to mind for me because I spent a good couple of chats with Gordon Stout. And of course, Gordon is one of the many names that was on that took part in that festival and placed in the competition.
Actually, since you mentioned it, Stout was one of the judges for that competition. But Shi Yi Wu posted a picture on Facebook just a couple of days ago of her with Eric Samu.
I saw that.
Me with my friend Eric of 20 years or something like that. And I think they met, or at least that was one of their first meetings, was at that competition where he took first place and I think Shi Yi took second or third. But yeah,
something like that. Yeah, but you spelled out all the details back on episode 6. So yeah, this was one of those. I mean, it would make more sense to list the people who weren't there because there were just so many. It was such a like splash of marimba competition and what that is. So cool. Okay, so good job. 1 point for Ben. So next question. On episode 157, we brought up the topic of having a visual performance persona with our guest Lynn Vartan. We all agreed that Lynn has a very wonderful and distinctive artist persona and image as she performs, and she credits watching and getting her stylized influences from Stephen Schick and who else?
Evelyn Glennie.
Oh, Ben, good job. Another one for Ben. Cool. See, I'm trying to, keep everyone's scores a little close. So
you shouldn't admit that, Casey.
Oh, I guess you're right. Yeah, it's got to be a tight competition, though. It wasn't something Ben reported on.
I wasn't even on that episode.
That's the downfall of
you gotta watch.
So if you're not on an episode, you better watch.
You gotta listen.
You have to listen if you weren't on one. I've got a good one of those for you coming up, Megan. Not in this quiz, but on another one where it's like definitely in your favor. But anyway, another point for Ben. So let's see. Oh god, this is so this is gonna be too easy for Ben. So you can hear this guest finger snaps on a very well-known Addams Family theme song recording. Who is it?
Hey, Mom Richards.
Oh, Mom got it. Good.
Nice. Oh.
So that was one that Ben reported on way back on episode 82 with Emil Richards. So yeah,
Emil Richards. On our end, I said that before we heard Laurel.
That's correct.
Oh man, that's too bad. It's coming in for me. That is not
all right.
Just flat out not fair.
So if you go visit Casey, and Laurel, but you report in Casey's office, that's the best chance of.
I guess if you guys know a better way of doing this, I'm hip. Sometimes it is about the equipment and gear you have and. The ping time of the internet connection could be significant.
You're right.
Yeah. So yeah, anyway, that was definitely Mo Richards back on episode 5, Ben reported on it. And then Emo was our guest on episode 82. Also mentioned in that segment was Emo's performance on Jaws, The Exorcist, Every Planet of the Apes movie, The Simpsons xylophone lick, the bongos on Mission Impossible, and, Up, Family Guy, Flintstones, Ghostbusters, Indiana Jones, multiple Star Trek movies, and literally 2,000 more movies in addition to those.
That was a ridiculous episode. I mean, that guy's credits are just unbelievable. And what a character. That was so fun.
Yeah, it's crazy. And to think the people who are there, like I think of our friend Ted Akatz, he's in LA doing stuff with film music and recording. But I mean, the slice that anyone today gets compared to that is just, could you ever get that many calls nowadays?
Right.
I don't even know, is that
possible?
Yeah,
it's different now. Yeah.
Anyway. Well, cool. Nice job, you guys. That was really fun. And man, David Robinson, thank you so much for joining us. It was really cool to have a band director here.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I was thinking all week, I was thinking if I was being punked by Ben, so it actually happened. So cool. Thanks for having me.
I didn't ask you, but I just said you've been volunteered to do this podcast.
You're doing this podcast.
You've been nominated. Yeah. Well, anyway, you guys, thanks so much. We'll catch you next week when we'll have composer Adam Silverman. So thanks, guys. Catch you later.
Cool. Cool. Awesome. Bye.